Thank you for coming this evening. If there are visitors among us, I want to be sure to let you know I'm not Ken Stegall. He's away on a trip, a command performance from his mother, I think, that she asked him to come and preach a series of lessons at the church in Oklahoma where they live, and it was an offer he could not refuse. And thanks, Annie, for the singing tonight. The song we just sang turns out to be quite apropos to the lesson. And so you can turn, if you wish, to 2 Samuel, the middle chapters, along about 15, 16, 17 or so. And you can follow some of this material, but I'm going to put most of it on the screen for you to read. And so we'll read it together. And that way we're both reading from the same versions. Let's see, I'm going to try to control this equipment from up here. I've got to get organized here. There we go. To begin with, we're going to look at a verse of Scripture from the Gospels in John 13 and 18. Jesus was speaking to his disciples. He said, I'm not referring to all of you. I know those I have chosen, but this is to fulfill the Scripture. And then he gives a quotation from the Old Testament that's kind of a little bit remote, a little mysterious. He who shares my bread has lifted up his heel against me. And further on down a few verses later, he says, I tell you the truth, one of you is going to betray me. And you remember that scene. They all ask each other, who is it, who is it? And of course, we know the outcome of that. Who was it? It was Judas Iscariot. But what about the verse of Scripture? He who shares my bread has lifted up his heel against me. As you know, in the Old Testament, what we call the Old Testament, the Hebrew Bible, there were no chapters or verses for reference. And so the master, as he taught his disciples, would quote a scripture and they were expected to know where it was. And the context would tell them even more information. He was referring to Psalm 41 and 9, where David is speaking. Even my close friend, whom I trusted, he who shared my bread has lifted up his heel against me. That's what Jesus was referring to, obviously, wasn't it? Who's David talking about? He's talking about somebody who betrayed him. And that's the connection between the verse in the Gospel of John and the verse in the Psalms, is that they both speak about one who betrayed. And there are more parallels in this story than even that. And so we know specifically who the individual was who betrayed David. Now, there were many people who opposed David at various points along the way, and you might say, well, how can we know who he was talking about at this time? But there is a specific individual who fits the pattern, and we know actually who he's talking about from the context in Psalm 41, and we'll look at that context in a few minutes. David was talking about a man named Ahithophel. In 1 Chronicles, these verses are in other parts of the Hebrew Bible, but in 1 Chronicles 27, 33, and 34, there's a list of people who served David, his people in his court, the people who were part of his cabinet, we might say, or his government. Ahithophel was the king's counselor. Hushai, the Archite, was the king's friend. And those two individuals play a role in the story that we will recount for you tonight. Ahithophel was succeeded by Jehoiada, son of Benaiah, and by Abiathar. Joab was the commander of the royal army. The fact that Ahithophel was succeeded by somebody else tells you something, doesn't it? He was at one time David's advisor, but something happened. And he was no longer the advisor, and he was succeeded by other men. Now, the advisor to the king surrounded himself with wise people, as you would expect. And Ahithophel was an individual of very peculiar and important capability. 2 Samuel 16 and 23 tells us, now, in those days, the advice Ahithophel gave, if you know someone like this, the advice Ahithophel gave was like that of one who inquires of God. That was how both David and Absalom, another character in our story, that's how they regarded all of Ahithophel's advice. It doesn't say that Ahithophel inquired of God. Notice that. In fact, who could inquire of God? Could David inquire of God? Actually, he had to go to somebody else who had the tools to inquire of God, only the high priest, who had this peculiar set of dominoes or dice or something that were cast to give answers. And that was called the Urim and the Thummim. You remember that. So you had to go to the high priest to inquire of God. Not just anybody could do that. So Ahithophel wasn't inquiring of God, but he gave answers that sounded as though he had. Ahithophel was a very wise man. He was insightful. He was observant and thoughtful, and took his job seriously. And he always tried to give David the very best advice. A parallel in our modern times might be Captain Kirk and Mr. Spock. You remember that relationship in the stories that we've seen on television. Kirk would say, the Klingons are bearing down upon us, and our warp drive is under repair, and we're running out of ammunition. Spock, what should we do? And of course, Spock had an answer, didn't he? He'd say something like, use impulse drive to move us to a position behind that nearby planet where we're hidden from the Klingons, and then raise the shields and perhaps the device that cloaks us so they can't see us. And that all made sense. If there was an answer, Spock had the answer. And that's Ahithophel to David. He advised him in battle plans, government, politics, everything except one topic that he was not well versed in. In fact, I suspect, although it doesn't say so, I suspect he was rather suspicious of David's relationship to God. He didn't inquire of God. There's no indication that he ever prayed a prayer. And we shall see in his attitude toward things that he took some very despicable actions at some points. And he is obviously going to be a traitor. So he doesn't bear a close relationship to God. But he is very wise with human wisdom. You've known people like that, haven't you? They can analyze a situation and give you advice on raising your children or on your job or whatever you need. And sometimes they offer the advice and you didn't ask for it, but that's another story. So that's Ahithophel. Now we'll see how this plays out. The background of the story has to do with David and Bathsheba. David was rocking along in his life pretty well until he hit the bump in the road that was Bathsheba, wasn't it? What followed was adultery and murder and the source of David's troubles for the rest of his life. In the 2 Samuel, the 11th chapter, we see that story where David's up wandering around on the roof of the palace and he looks down and he sees a woman bathing. He should have averted his eyes and gone back inside, was what he should have done. And in fact, he should have been out with the army in battle. He had stayed home instead of going out to lead his army. The woman was very beautiful, and David sent someone to find out about her. The man said, "Isn't this Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliam, and the wife of Uriah the Hittite?" Now, who are Eliam and Uriah? Here you have to go read some of these lists of names, and you go through them pretty fast when you're reading the Bible, and you'd say, "Well, I don't know any. I can't even pronounce these names. Why should I study this?" But in 2 Samuel 23, verses 24, 34, and 39, we have these names. They're in a list of 30, a group of men called the 30. Actually, the 37, I think, if you count through the list. It may be that some of the men in the list had died and were replaced by others, and that the living list was actually only 30. We really don't know. But among the 30 were Eliam, the son of Ahithophel the Gilonite. That's our Ahithophel. And Uriah the Hittite. They were warriors of the first rank and heroes in David's army. Men of great respect and very valuable to David. So Eliam was the son of Ahithophel, and Eliam was the father of Bathsheba. So what's Bathsheba's relationship to Ahithophel? The Bible never tells you this unless you go read these lists. But Ahithophel was Bathsheba's grandfather. David surely knew all about Ahithophel's family. Why didn't he recognize Bathsheba? She probably had been playing around the palace in the past as she was growing up. And evidently she was a very young and beautiful woman. David just never had noticed her before. And so, Sinfar, how is it that Bathsheba married Uriah, a Hittite? The Hebrews were only supposed to marry other Hebrews. Can you imagine a situation here that might explain that? Eliam was a soldier. Perhaps Uriah had saved his life. And the marriages were arranged by the fathers. So this is an interesting clue, isn't it? Maybe Eliam gave his daughter to Uriah in reward for some meritorious army business of some sort. Maybe he had saved Eliam's life. But anyway, what would you think Ahithophel, a wise man, an egghead in David's employ, would think about his granddaughter marrying a Hittite? He might not have liked that. In fact, I suspect he didn't. But it doesn't say that. Now, we're going to draw some conclusions about what Ahithophel thought and some of his motives. And we can do that if we take the tack that he was completely logical in everything that he did. And in fact, it makes a lot of sense when we look at that part of his life. So let's do that. Keep that in mind. That's what we're doing. We're going to draw some conclusions about Ahithophel's activities by analyzing his motives in terms of logical behavior. He didn't pray to God. He didn't ask God to intervene. He just did what he thought was best in every situation that he found himself. All right, the rebellion. David had several sons. He actually had five wives. They each had a son. And we know the fate of four of them. We don't know the fate of one, but the four that we do know are spelled out for us in 2 Samuel. Absalom had actually murdered Amnon. You remember that story? Amnon had ravished Absalom's sister Tamar. And so, in retribution, a couple of years after the event, so that it wasn't obvious, I suppose, Absalom murdered Amnon. So there goes one of David's sons, his oldest. And Absalom had to flee the country. He went to Geshur, which was the country where there was a king who was his mother's father, who was the king of Geshur. That's his grandfather. He spent some years there in exile, eventually got to come back to Israel and be a part of David's family. But he was always sort of a cast-off because of his rash behavior, and I suspect people didn't trust him. However, he was very handsome and moderately intelligent. And I suspect that may be part of the story here. In the course of time, he decides he wants to be the next king. Now, he's not supposed to be the next king. Who's supposed to be the king to follow David? Already at this point in time, Solomon had been born, of course, shortly after Bathsheba was taken into the royal family. And he was probably a teenager at about this time, Solomon. And so Absalom figured he ought to be king, not Solomon. But God had loved Solomon. And it says, and David reports later on, that God had told him that Solomon would sit on his throne. That comes into play in the first chapter of 1 Kings when you get over there and look at the rebellion of the last of the other sons, that's Adonijah. But anyway, we're talking here about Absalom. And here's the story. You can read through this. In the course of time, Absalom provided himself with a chariot and horses and with 50 men to run ahead of him. He's decided, if I'm going to be king, I'm going to have to act like king. And he picks a time in the life of David when David is somehow ill. We don't know anything about this. It's not told anywhere except in David's writings himself. We'll read that in a minute. So there's some question about David. Is he going to recover or not? And so Absalom decides, I better move now. Actually, he starts this before he makes that decision to rebel. He spends several years actually building up his political base, we would say in modern terms. So he goes around in his chariot with runners ahead of him. He would get up early and stand by the side of the road leading to the city gate whenever anyone came with a complaint to be placed before the king for a decision. Absalom would call out to him, "What town are you from?" And the person would answer, "Oh, I'm your servant. Your servant is from such and such a place in Israel." Then Absalom would say to him, "Look, your claims are valid and proper." How did Absalom know that? He's guessing, isn't he? Actually, he's just politicking. "But there's no representative of the king to hear you." And Absalom would add, "If only I were appointed to be the judge of the land, then everyone who has a complaint or case could come to me and I would see that he gets justice." You ever hear that in our modern day from any of the politicians trying to get elected? I think we hear something similar, don't we? And also, notice how he's royalty now. Whenever anyone approached him to bow down before him, he would reach out his hand, take hold of him, and kiss him. Absalom behaved this way toward all the Israelites who came to the king seeking justice. And so he stole the hearts of the men of Israel. He does this for years, about 4 years. At the end of 4 years, Absalom said to the king, he picks a time when the king is sick now, "Let me go to Hebron to fulfill a vow I made to the Lord. While your servant was living in Geshur in Aram, while he was in exile, you see, I made this vow. If the Lord takes me back to Jerusalem, I will worship the Lord in Hebron." He's going to offer some animal sacrifices in Hebron is what he's saying here. He's not just going to Hebron to go to church. It's a serious business that he's doing something concerning a vow. However, you'll see that it's all a false front. King said to him, "Go in peace." So he went to Hebron. And then Absalom sent secret messengers throughout the tribes of Israel to say, "As soon as you hear the sound of the trumpets, then say, 'Absalom is king in Hebron.'" 200 men from Jerusalem had accompanied Absalom. They had been invited as guests and went quite innocently, knowing nothing about the matter. While Absalom was offering sacrifices, he also sent for Ahithophel the Gilonite, David's counselor, to come down from Gilo, his hometown. And so the conspiracy gained strength, and Absalom's following kept on increasing. And then a messenger goes to David and told him, "The hearts of the men of Israel are with Absalom." Latest polls show that Absalom's leading, right? And so we got to do something. And what David decides to do at that point is kind of interesting. But let's look at David's situation. In Psalm 41, these are the verses leading up to the one that Jesus quoted about my friend, my familiar friend who shared my bread has lifted up his heel against me. That's verse 9. We're looking at the first 8 verses. "Blessed is he who has regard for the weak. The Lord delivers him from in times of trouble." Many of the Psalms start out that way. "The Lord will protect him and preserve his life. He will bless him in the land and not surrender him to the desire of his foes. The Lord will sustain him on his sick bed and restore him from his bed of illness." There's the clue as to what's going on here when Absalom rebels. "I said, 'O Lord, have mercy on me and heal me, for I have sinned against you.' My enemies say of me in malice, 'When will he die and his name perish?' Every king has enemies, do you suppose?" And they see the possibilities here that David's going to pass from the scene. "Whenever one comes to see me, he spoke falsely, while his heart gathers slander," and then he goes out and spreads it abroad. Please, when you go visit somebody that's sick, don't follow these examples. "All my enemies whisper together against me. They imagine the worst for me, saying, 'A vile disease has beset him. He will never get up from the place where he lies.'" So that tells you what the scene is in David's health when Absalom chooses to rebel. Now, if a son takes the king's throne, we can stop and put a piece of logical wisdom into the scene. It's a very dangerous time in any kingdom, and particularly when the son who's going to become king is a murderer. What's he going to do to the other contenders for the throne? They won't be allowed to live, will they? And so Ahithophel knows this. Why did the rebellion happen? Well, the timing of the rebellion was related to David's illness, but the cause of David's sin with the cause was David's sin with Bathsheba and the murder of Uriah. We all understand that, don't we? 2 Samuel 12:9, when Nathan comes to him with the report, the little story about the man with the single ewe lamb that the rich man took and made a dinner for a visitor. And so Nathan told him, well, you won't die. David was very concerned because someone who murders someone and someone who commits adultery, the penalty was death. But the Lord goes on telling him, although I've forgiven your sin, you're going to have a lot of trouble. Why did you despise the word of the Lord by doing what is evil in his eyes? You struck down Uriah the Hittite with the sword, took his wife to be your own. You killed him with the sword of the Ammonites. Now, therefore, the sword will never depart from your house. And for the rest of his life, his sons and his people gave him trouble. Because you despised me and took the wife of Uriah the Hittite to be your own. So David fled. Absalom's coming with a large crowd. And David, rather than subject the city of Jerusalem to a battle, possible destruction, David and his followers left the city and traveled on foot toward the Jordan River, about 20 miles downhill, distant to the east. And in 2 Samuel 15 and 31, now David had been told, Ahithophel is among the conspirators with Absalom. So David prayed, O Lord, turn Ahithophel's counsel into foolishness. David went to the source that could help him, didn't he? Ahithophel is not quite as smart as David. David sent his friend Hushai the Archite into Absalom's court to counter Ahithophel's advice. And you might wonder, why would Ahithophel listen to Hushai? But Hushai went very cleverly to meet Absalom and convinced him that he was transferring his allegiance to Absalom. So, Ahithophel's advice to Absalom. Absalom came to the palace, found that David had flown away, had fled away. No airplanes in that situation. He fled away and was gone with most of his people. And so Absalom asked Ahithophel, what shall we do? And the scene there suggests that Absalom is going to depend completely on Ahithophel's advice. The first thing Ahithophel tells Absalom to do is to ravish David's concubines. You remember that story. That's not worth discussing in public, but nonetheless, it was an interesting piece of advice that Ahithophel gave that tells you his morals are not what they ought to be. Then Ahithophel said to Absalom, let me choose 12,000 men and set out tonight in pursuit of David. David's sick. He's traveling slowly. We know where he's going. We'll pursue him. I will attack him when he's weary and weak. I will strike him with terror, and then all the people with him will flee. I'll strike down only the king and bring all the people back to you. Ahithophel's not loyal to David, is he? Any more than Judas was to Jesus. The situation changed. And he changed his mind. And he decides he would be the one to kill the king. I will strike down only the king and bring all the people back to you. The death of the man you seek will mean the return of all. All of the people will be unharmed. And this plan seemed good to Absalom and to all the elders of Israel. But Hushai offered an alternate plan to Absalom. We won't read it. It's a long discourse. But what he offered to Absalom was another picture. Let's wait a few days gather together a huge army, and you ride on a white horse out in front of the army and lead the army into battle, and there's obviously going to be a civil war here. You lead them into battle, and we will overwhelm David and his men and destroy them. That was in a thumbnail sketch of Hushai's advice. And that appealed to Absalom's pride, didn't it? Absalom and all the men of Israel said, the advice of Hushai the Archite is better than that of Ahithophel. For the Lord had determined to frustrate the good advice of Ahithophel in order to bring disaster on Absalom. The Lord's going to intervene. Was Ahithophel's advice good? If they had followed that advice, would it probably have worked? I think so. David was sick and weak, and they were disorganized, and here comes this big army, they would have overwhelmed them. 10,000 men would have been plenty. When Ahithophel saw that his advice had not been followed, this might be the first time that had ever happened, he saddled his donkey, set out for his house in his hometown. He put his house in order, then hanged himself. So he died and was buried in his father's tomb. Parallel there too, isn't it? With Judas, who hanged himself. When he saw that the plan he had proposed wasn't going to work, that's what he did. And both Ahithophel and Judas failed to take into account one key bit of information. What was it? Why did Ahithophel join the rebellion in the first place? Absalom might become king while David was sick. Absalom would then kill all of the other contenders for the throne of Israel. And you see that again and again in the stories that we have in 1 and 2 Kings, with all the kings that followed, especially the evil kings. Ahithophel, in his superior human wisdom, should be able to outsmart Absalom. I think he felt that way. Absalom's inexperienced, easily led by pride, not very bright. He should be able to outsmart Absalom and protect Bathsheba and Solomon. That's what Ahithophel wanted to do, and that probably is a good motive, isn't it? After all, it's his daughter and grandson. Ahithophel may have intended to gain control of the army. You see, if he takes 10,000 of the choice men, goes after King David, he doesn't have to stop there. He could come back, kill Absalom, and hand the throne to Solomon, who at the time was only a teenager. So that would be his logical reasoning for joining the rebellion, so he could be in control. But in doing so, he had to reject David and be a traitor to David. What should he have done? He should have reported Ahithophel's activities to David, shouldn't he? And advised David on what to do. But you see, he saw David as being weak. And the throne's going to have to be taken by somebody else anyway. It might as well be Absalom, but we're going to have the same problem if we wait to Adonijah becoming king, because he will destroy the other sons as well. Why did Ahithophel hang himself? If his advice was not followed, Ahithophel knew that David would win the civil war to follow. He could see that. Handwriting on the wall, as we say. If David won, then Bathsheba and Solomon would be safe. That was his goal anyway, wasn't it? Absalom would probably be killed, and that's exactly what happened. If David won, then Ahithophel would be branded a traitor. And what happens to traitors? Well, they couldn't shoot him. They could shoot him with an arrow, bow and arrow. They couldn't shoot him with a gun, but he would probably be executed. That's what Ahithophel thought, because it was logical. What do you think David would have done to Ahithophel if he came back and pled for mercy? Time and again, we see David unwilling to kill King Saul. His enemies on every hand, they would come back and fall at his feet. That happened on the return from the trip to Jordan at this point. When he came back up to take over the palace again, the people who had been throwing rocks at him as he left, he forgave them. I think he would have forgiven Ahithophel if he had asked. But you see, Ahithophel didn't believe in mercy. That's a sign of weakness. And you may know people who feel the same way. So the conclusions. Ahithophel reasoned only from human wisdom. His motive was good, but he did not ask for God's help. That's what, of course, we know to do. He also believed that David would show him no mercy. He did not understand the relationship David had with God that assured David's success in spite of his sin and all of these circumstances. He didn't have Ahithophel to advise him anymore, but he still knew what to do, didn't he? And he had the high priest to inquire of God on some occasions connected with this. Human wisdom is not enough. Life requires wisdom from God. James 1:5 says, if any of you lacks wisdom, he should ask God, who gives generously to all without finding fault. It will be given to him. Did you know that? Doesn't matter your background. He doesn't find fault in you if you go to him and ask for wisdom. Who did that? Ahithophel's great-grandson did that. Solomon asked God for wisdom, and God gave it to him. 1 Corinthians. Now the foolishness of God is wiser than man's wisdom, and the weakness of God is stronger than man's strength. God's wisdom will see you through any difficult situation. And in Jeremiah 10:23, I know, O Lord, that a man's life is not his own. It is not for man to direct his steps. So, here we have the story of a man who depended on his own wisdom. He's a valuable resource in many situations, but not in life in general, is he? And you know men and women who are living their lives by their own bootstraps, so to speak. They're depending upon their ability to make sense out of life and reach the logical conclusions to the problems that they face without God. That in itself is foolish, isn't it? So, where do you stand? Do you depend on God's wisdom to see you through your daily life? Or do you try to figure out the logical answer to everything, every problem that you face? What we know to do is to ask for God's help. He will abundantly help us if we will only ask. Perhaps you've lived your life without God and you need to become a Christian. Christians have a tremendous resource in God's help. And we invite you to make that choice tonight, if you will, or if you need to come back to God, please come while we offer the invitation song. Please stand.